Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, justice from the heart of the Phantom of the Opera. Hello, everyone, and welcome back, finally, to episode 19 of In This Labyrinth. I am, as always, your host, Phantom Femme, and I know I say this every single time, and it's always true, sorry yet again for an extraordinarily long hiatus. As you can imagine, things have been a bit derailed for the past several weeks. Thankfully, I and all of my family have managed to be safe and well so far, and I really hope all you out there have too. But even so, all this lockdown and social distancing certainly makes life more complicated, not less, as I'm sure many of you out there are finding too. Plus, ostensibly having all this spare time, I keep taking on more projects than I should, and thus running behind on them, more so than usual? You'd think I'd have learned better work balance and time management after all these years. But apparently not yet. In any case, that brings me to the other reason that things have been on a bit of hiatus and why this episode's taken so damn long to get actually up and on the air, which is that you'll have perhaps have noticed some changes in the show. So, yeah, since things were derailed and on hiatus anyway, I thought I'd take the time to do a bit of renovating and retweaking. So, among other things, you'll perhaps have noticed the new, much shorter, intro to the podcast. I hope folks like it. So that's some of what I've been doing while the show's been on its latest unplanned hiatus. And I will be going back over the next few weeks and putting the new intro into the old episodes, but that's going to take me a while. But I didn't want to just wait till I'd gotten all that done before getting the new episode out and getting the show back up on the air, because it's been delayed long enough, goodness knows. So yeah, for a while then, various older episodes will still have the old intro music in them until I can get around to getting them all changed over. So hopefully that's not too confusing. And that reminds me, thank everyone hugely for tuning in, especially thank anyone who's new to the show, who's newly started listening. That's awesome. And thank everyone also who's tuning back in. Thank you all for sticking with this in spite of all the long hiatuses. So, I've got a really, exciting might not be the right word, but hopefully really interesting and hopefully thought-provoking episode for you all today. We're gonna kind of dive right back in after the long break, so I hope you all enjoy it. Or, as I said, at least find it interesting and thought-provoking. Before I begin, though, I just want to give a bit of a content warning, because this episode will discuss violence, including gendered violence, violence against women. Now, there certainly won't be anything detailed or explicit, certainly nothing any worse than you'd find, say, in reading the LaRue or Susan K. novels, or than you'd see on stage in the original Lloyd Webber musical. But still, I wanted to give a bit of a heads up, just so that folks can manage their self-care as needed, because of course I want everyone to be safe and comfortable listening to this. So, I've been thinking about doing this episode for a long time now, because a whole bunch of times over the past year or so, really, I've been seeing discussions come up on various blogs, Facebook groups, etc., about whether, in fact, Phantom glorifies or romanticizes violence, and particularly gendered violence, violence against women. I've seen a bunch of discussions come up about whether, in fact, Phantom falls into the trope and the trap of reading the Phantom's violent behavior as a measure of his love for Christine. And so I really wanted to weigh in on and respond to those discussions, because I would say the answer to that is no, it doesn't, but I think it's really important to lay out and discuss why. Because, in honesty, I can see how people get that, although, as I said, I would disagree. I don't think Phantom does support or glorify or romanticize violence, much less violence against women. And with respect, I would suggest that reading it as doing so is a bit of an oversimplification. That said, though, and sort of leaping right into the discussion, even though I disagree with those who argue that Phantom glorifies or romanticizes or even condones the Phantom's violence, including against Christine, I think it's extremely important for us fans not to minimize the violence that the Phantom does. And in fact, certainly the source texts, the LaRue novel, the Susan Kay novel, the Lloyd Webber stage musical, don't minimize it. They all portray a man who is jealously possessive of his salary and his control over the opera house and of Christine, and whose jealousy can turn quite violent when it is thwarted, when people try to buck his control. And I think that no matter how much we ultimately love and empathize with the Phantom, it does a disservice to the story and to us as fans when we sort of sweep that under the rug or minimize it. And related to that, I think it's also incredibly important that we as fans don't try to excuse or minimize the Phantom's violence toward Christine by saying, oh, well, he was never or hardly ever physically violent with her or towards her. It is true that the Phantom's violence towards Christine was more psychological than directly physical, but that still counts as violence. Like, threatening harm to the people around Christine, to the people he knows she loves and cares about, that is still violent, abusive behavior. And it's really important for us fans to resist the temptation to make like it isn't just because he's not actually physically beating up on her. Now, we can understand why the Phantom is violent, even if we can't excuse or condone it, because it's easy to imagine reading the LaRue novel or seeing the Lloyd Webber stage musical, and certainly the Susan Kay novel and the Jerick, the 2004 film, make clear that he hasn't exactly had good role models of what a healthy relationship looks like. Sure. And indeed, that's a point I'll come back to later. But even so, even as we understand and empathize, I think it's incredibly important for us not to try to minimize or hide from the violence the Phantom does. Because as I said, the source texts certainly don't. And I think trying to hide from that, does a disservice to the story and to us as fans. for reasons that I'll get to shortly. Because, in fact, the fact that the Phantom is a potentially and sometimes actually violent, dangerous man is part of what gives the story its power, but not in the way that those who accuse it of glorifying or romanticizing violence think, not in the way that they're interpreting it as. But first, I want to take a small digression to address the issue of the Phantom manipulating Christine, being part of the psychological violence that he does to her. Because those who I've read accusing Phantom of glorifying or romanticizing the Phantom's violence toward Christine, that's often a huge part of what they refer to. And while it's definitely a valid accusation to make, it's one where you have to be very careful which version of Phantom you're talking about, because the degrees of manipulation and consent, I would argue, differ depending on which version of the story you're reading or watching. So, for example, the LaRue novel, Susan K. novel, and Jerick, 2004 film, all have Christine being completely deceived. They all have her completely and literally believing that Eric the Phantom is her angel of music sent by her father until the moment when he reveals himself as a human. But there's even differences there. There are even differences among those three because, for example, as I've argued before, whereas LaRue, and in fact, I didn't discuss this before, but Susan K. as well, kind of problematize that by suggesting that Christine is way more naive and gullible than she should be as nearly a grown woman, that she's been somehow kind of held back by this cultural expectation and expectation from her father of her being this absolutely pure, totally innocent little angel. The Jerick, of course, has the Phantom being her angel of music and teaching her since, in fact, she was a little child, a little kid, 7 years old. And so it frames him much more as abusing her legitimate trust. Whereas, as I've discussed before, the original stage version is much more ambiguous about that. Yes, it presents her as addressing the Phantom as her angel of music, but it also, in the fourth verse of the title song, as I've mentioned before, implies that she knows that he's a man and that this is a role play. Now, the ambiguity comes in that we're never told how she knows that he's human, or how much she's aware that this is a role play and how much she consciously consents to it. It's just sort of dropped there in the title song with no background or explanation given. And I take people's point, and it's really important, of course, to remember that partial consent or half-conscious consent or even unconscious consent is not at all the same thing as fully consciously given, fully informed consent. Nevertheless, the original stage version does contain that ambiguity. It does leave room for the fan or the audience to kind of fill in the blanks with their own imagination as to what level of consent there is there, as opposed to the other versions mentioned, which make it explicitly clear that she's completely deceived. Similarly, and relatedly, the Susan K. novel, the Jerick, and especially the original LaRue novel all portray Christine's first time in the Phantom's lair explicitly as an abduction, as a kidnapping. They all make it explicitly clear that she's been lured there into his world under false pretenses and is there against her will. But again, the original stage version makes that much more ambiguous. A lot depends on how the particular actors play it in any given performance. But it's always seemed to me that the original stage version plays those scenes, and here I'm talking about Act 1 scenes 3 through 5, basically, so the end of Angel of Music through the title song and Music of the Night, and in fact, pretty much up to the moment of the first unmasking in Act 1 scene 6, it's always seemed to me that the original stage version plays those scenes much more as a seduction than an abduction, much more as a seduction than as a kidnapping. I've always read Christina's going with the Phantom quite willingly at the end of Angel of Music when she goes through the mirror, and being with him quite willingly all through the title song and Music of the Night, and, as I said, really right up to the moment of the first unmasking. So, thank you for bearing with that digression. But I really thought it was important to tease out some of those differences between versions with regard to the issue of Eric the Phantom manipulating or deceiving Christine. Because, as you can see, the different versions handle that issue in quite distinct ways. And in fact, they handle Eric the Phantom's other violence in distinct ways too. Because, for example, LaRue and Susan Kay both give Eric extensive histories of violence before he comes to the Opera House. And the Jerrick, the 2004 film, gives the Phantom a history of violence, but much less extensive, and frames it much more as self-defense, at least until things go badly between him and Christine. The stage version, meanwhile, is once again much more ambiguous, because you're told very, very little, you're told hardly anything really, of the Phantom's backstory. That whole flashback sequence with Madame Giry seeing him a prisoner in the Traveling Fair as a child and then rescuing him is not in the original, is not in the original stage version. I gather it was sort of incorporated into the 25th anniversary concert and into the Lawrence Connor production, but it's not in the original staging. All the original stage version tells you is that he was seen locked in a cage in the Traveling Fair as a man, but you don't know whether he was really, you're not told whether he was really truly a prisoner or whether it was an act. And you're told that they boasted that he'd once built for the Shah of Persia, but you're never told whether that's true or not. The only way you know that is to fill in information from the LaRue novel. So all that to say, the stage version never tells you definitely whether the Phantom has a history of violence before coming to the Opera House or not. You assume that he must have learned how to use the Punjab lasso somewhere, but again, you're never told exactly where or when or how, unless you fill it in from LaRue. What the stage version does show you, though, is a Phantom whose violence escalates. Because, as awesome YouTuber Lindsay Ellis points out, actually in her video on the Jerrick, we start out in the Hannibal scene, Act 1, Scene 1, with the Phantom playing what is essentially a prank on Carlotta. It might be a rather mean and nasty prank meant to scare the shit out of her, but it's nevertheless a prank. He doesn't actually harm anyone. And then, as I said, in Acts 1, Scenes 3, 4, and 5, you see him in this interesting, ambiguous, but possibly consensual role-play relationship with Christine. And then, after the first unmasking, after Act 1, Scene 6, it raises the stakes, as Lindsay Ellis put it. You start to see him making threats against Raoul and against the management, and then you see him actually carrying out those threats. making Carlotta lose her voice. Okay, that could be a prank. Again, a nasty prank, but a prank. But then murdering Joseph Bouquet. And then dropping the chandelier. And then threatening to do worse than the chandelier if the managers don't perform his opera in Act 2, Scene 1 at the end of Masquerade. And then, of course, ultimately murdering Piangi to take his place on stage. Definitely kidnapping Christine this time down to the final lair. And then threatening to murder Raoul if she doesn't marry him. So, as I said, the stage version doesn't have much to say about the Phantom's backstory in terms of his history of violence, but in terms of what you actually see portrayed on stage, it shows this pattern of ambiguity at first, and then escalating violence after the first unmasking. And then escalating again after the rooftop scene, after All I Ask of You in Act 1, Scene 10, when Christine and Raoul pledge their love. Because he's already murdered Joseph Bouquet, and then after All I Ask of You, he drops the chandelier, threatens the management with worse, and of course murders Piangi and the final lair. And yet, in spite of all the histories of violence that the different versions of the story give us for Eric, give us for the Phantom, they all agree on or converge around encouraging the reader or audience member or viewer to sympathize with the Phantom. And in many of us, to wish that Christine had chosen him and not Raoul. And that's the part that those who accuse Phantom of glorifying or romanticizing violence object to. That's how they get that. They feel that portraying the Phantom as a sympathetic, even compelling character, that there's a reason why Christine was drawn to him. Well, they feel that portraying him as a sympathetic character excuses his violence, and that portraying him as a compelling character whom there was a reason why Christine was drawn to him romanticizes it. And just as an aside, and with all due respect, I was saying earlier that us fans, we need to be very careful not to minimize or brush aside the Phantom's violence or sweep it under the rug. And that's partly why. Because when we do that, it definitely feeds the perception that Phantom itself glorifies or excuses or condones violence against women. And I hope we don't want to contribute to that perception. So we need to be very careful not to romanticize or excuse or condone the Phantom's violence as fans. And I believe it's perfectly possible to do that without sacrificing our sympathy and compassion for the Phantom. And, in fact, to segue back into where I was going before that, I believe and would very much argue that the story itself, whether in LaRue or Susan Kay, or, and in fact, especially the Lloyd Webber stage musical, does exactly that. It gives us a very sympathetic, very compassionate portrayal. Maybe sympathetic's the wrong word, especially in LaRue, but certainly a very compassionate. Yeah, no, I think sympathetic is the right word. A very sympathetic and compassionate portrayal of the Phantom, even while not accepting his violent behavior as okay. And the story does that in two key ways, both of which are, I think, really key to what makes Phantom so incredibly powerful. The first is, and this is something I've always really valued about Phantom, even before I actually had the language to express and articulate it, and that is that Phantom is exquisitely trauma aware. And in particular, it refuses to flinch away from or avoid the fact that and the ways that people who are traumatized, especially if that trauma isn't well processed and dealt with, often take it out on or pass it on to others. People with unhealed trauma often behave in ways that are very harmful and even destructive toward themselves and those around them and even toward people they love. That's a very common pattern. And we see that really exquisitely portrayed in the character of the Phantom in LaRue, Kay, and Lloyd Webber. And as I said before, that's one of the things that I find the most valuable and powerful in Phantom, because I feel like there's often a tendency to skip over or flinch away from that part of trauma and portray traumatized people as saints who've somehow risen above it to have this wonderful, super compassionate, super generous outlook on life. And it is certainly true that many traumatized people get there. But the operative word is get there, right? We don't start there. For many of us, we start much more like the Phantom, acting out of our trauma and in the process hurting people we care about and love, and not doing ourselves any good either. You know, I've done that, and if we're honest with ourselves, we probably all have at some point. Although how much so will probably depend on the kind and the extent of your trauma. And as I said, I really value the fact that Phantom refuses to gloss that over. Now, that's not the same thing as condoning it. And as I said, I don't think Phantom does. Indeed, I would argue that far from romanticizing the Phantom's violence as a measure of the depth of his love for Christine, I would say that Phantom actually frames his violence as a measure of his trauma, of how wounded he is psychologically and spiritually by having been so radically excluded and driven to the margins of society and beyond. And in the process, having never really learned healthy and non-exploitive ways to relate to people. Or, in fact, I would reverse that, having only learned unhealthy and highly exploitive ways of relating to people, because that's the only kind of relationship he's ever experienced. And again, that's a very, very common pattern with traumatized people to replicate really unhealthy and exploitive relationship modes because that's all you know. And having to make a really conscious, intentional effort to learn what a healthy relationship actually looks and feels like. Which brings us to the second way in which Phantom, LaRue, Kay, and Lloyd Webber, and I would say here especially the Lloyd Webber stage version, treats Eric's, the Phantom's, violence sympathetically and compassionately, but without condoning it. And that's that it gestures really powerfully and, I think, ironically, unintentionally on the part of the original creators. I very much doubt this was done consciously, but nevertheless, it gestures toward the concept of transformative justice as opposed to punitive justice. Punitive justice or retributive justice, justice based on retribution, is what we all are probably most familiar with, right? The idea that if you do something wrong, if you commit a crime, you get punished. And the idea is that the punishment both exacts revenge, retribution, on behalf of the person, people, institution that you harmed, and it's supposed to act as a deterrent to scare you into not committing further crimes. And we can really see this model embodied in the Lloyd Webber stage musical in Act Two in Raoul's plot to use the Phantom's opera to catch him and have him either arrested or shot by the police. And the idea is that in having the Phantom arrested or shot, he will pay for his crimes. And a different sort of punitive or retributive justice is also embodied in the mob in the Final Lair. That's a more sort of vigilante justice, but it's based on the same principle of exacting revenge. In fact, they even say revenge for Piangi, revenge for Bouquet, and on the idea of debt, on the idea of making the Phantom pay. And if I may, that, I think, is where those who accuse Phantom of condoning or romanticizing violence and violence against women get offended or at least disappointed, because it seems to me that they want to see the Phantom punished for his acts of violence, and of course he isn't. His actions are framed as problematic, but the Phantom himself is not simply condemned and thrown away as a villain. Instead, as I mentioned before, the story, and I would argue especially the Lloyd Webber stage musical, really strongly gestures toward transformative justice. Now, what the hell do I mean by that? Well, transformative justice is an alternative framework, an alternative way of handling harm and violence that was developed by BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, especially queer, trans, undocumented, sex worker, etc. BIPOC communities, for addressing harm and violence on and within those communities without or outside of the conventional criminal justice system. And this is why I'm like 98% sure that the gesture to transformative justice in Phantom, as powerful as it is coincidental or serendipitous rather than intentional, because as a bunch of super privileged straight white guys, I find it very hard to imagine that Andrew Lloyd Webber, Hal Prince, etc. would have been aware of what was being developed in these communities. In any case, transformative justice was being developed in these communities basically because of a convergence of politics and necessity. Many of them were already organizing against racism, poverty, shitty housing, police brutality, etc., and so were already developing anti-oppression frameworks. But alongside all that, these communities were also finding that going to the conventional criminal justice system, the police, etc., to try to get help with and deal with things like assault, intimate partner violence, etc., wasn't actually getting them any help. In fact, it was often A, not stopping the harm, and B, sometimes even making it worse. Because instead of getting help when coming forward as a victim of violence, people would often face victim blaming, sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, etc., or even deportation. And then, even when people were or are incarcerated for their crimes, they often emerge, certainly in no better shape, mentally, psychologically, and spiritually, and often in worse shape than when they went in. And now with the added stigma of a criminal record attached, often creating barriers to housing, employment, etc., and so would just fall very easily back into old patterns that were harmful to themselves and to others, and the cycle of poverty and violence would just repeat. So transformative justice then began to be developed by these communities in order to try to find a better, more effective way to deal with all this. a way that actually stopped the harm and prevented future harm, rather than, on one hand, subjecting victims to even further trauma, and on the other hand, yeah, locking people up for a while only to have them come out and then fall back into the same old patterns of destructive behavior. That's a bit of an oversimplification, because it's actually much more complex than that, but that's the basic gist. And of course, I'll put links to where you can read lots more about it in the blog post, in the blog notes for this episode. So, as you'll read in those sources, actual transformative justice interventions, because this is not just a theoretical framework, it actually has been put into practice in many instances. But what that looks like, the actual interventions, can take a wide variety of forms, of shapes, because of course it really depends on the specific situation. But they really, as I understand it, have two overriding and complementary goals. The first of those, of course, is to stop any active, ongoing harm that's happening. To stop whatever active violence is happening in the moment. And then the second goal, and this is where the transformative part of transformative justice comes in, is to prevent future harm, to prevent future violence, either toward the current victim or toward anyone else, by addressing the root causes, by addressing the social and material conditions that allowed that violence, that harm, to happen in the first place. And that's done by putting community structures in place to try to address those needs immediately at the micro, personal, and interpersonal level, even while obviously organizing for change on a larger macro scale too. Because transformative justice works from the premise, or works from the insight, that, to borrow a phrase from Mia Mingus's really excellent article that you'll find in the blog notes for this episode, interpersonal violence doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens in a context, or rather in a whole nest of contexts, from the very micro, family, and interpersonal context to the very macro context of economic systems and large-scale systems of racism, sexism, etc. And so, to address harm and violence, you have to not only address the immediate behavior, but you have to address those contexts as well, particularly if you want to not only stop present harm, but prevent future harm. And lest this sound like pie-in-the-sky lefty stuff, as I said, these principles of transformative justice have in fact been applied in practice. And in practice, they've been found to be much more effective at both stopping immediate harm and preventing future harm than traditional punitive justice methods. And you can read some actual examples of that in the links that I'll put in the blog post for this episode. So that's a basic thumbnail of what transformative justice is all about. But even from just that thumbnail, you can perhaps already see how, even though, as I said, I'm pretty sure Phantom's creators were unaware of the history and development of this framework, it is still, I would argue, very much in the spirit of these ideas. And in fact, the original Lloyd Webber stage musical does a brilliant job juxtaposing and contrasting traditional punitive / retributive justice and transformative justice, or the spirit of transformative justice. Because, as I mentioned before, you've got Raoul and his plot to catch the Phantom and have the police arrest or kill him, representing, you might say, official punitive or retributive justice. So the punishment and retribution officially sanctioned by and doled out by the state. Right? Because Raoul himself is an aristocrat, so he's part of the power structure. And then he calls on formal law enforcement to, quote-unquote, bring the Phantom to justice. But then you also have the mob, the lynch mob, that comes down after the Phantom in Act 2, Scenes 8 and 9, representing or embodying vigilante punitive slash retributive justice. Because they're not gendarmes, they're not police, they're not official law enforcement. They're just ordinary citizens who've decided to, as they say in Act 2, Scene 9, take revenge for Piangi and revenge for Bouquet. But in both these cases, in both the lynch mob and Raoul's plot to have the Phantom arrested, like, both their answers to the Phantom's violence is more violence. We're not explicitly told what the lynch mob plan to do once they get down to the Phantom's lair, but their tone in Act 2, Scene 9 is most definitely violent. And then, of course, back in Act 2, Scene 6, just before Don Juan Triumphant, Raoul tells the marksman in the orchestra pit to shoot to kill. But then, in contrast to this, we see the spirit of transformative justice really powerfully invoked in Act 2, Scene 9 in the way that Christine handles her choice. Because she starts with real fury. She starts by letting the Phantom know exactly how much he's hurt her and how angry she is at him. Quote, "The tears I might have shed for your dark fate grow cold and turn to tears of hate," unquote. And, quote, "Farewell, my fallen idol and false friend. One by one, I've watched illusion shatter," unquote, as it is on the original London cast recording. Or, quote, "We had such hopes, and now these hopes lie murdered," unquote, as it is in other versions. But in the end, when it comes down to it, she ultimately recognizes that the Phantom's violence, the violence he's done to her and to everybody else, is a product of the violence that's been done to him. And so she doesn't simply give in and surrender and give the Phantom what he ostensibly wants. Instead, she tries to address the underlying root cause that's actually driving his violent and wrong behavior, which is his exclusion from society, which is his having faced prejudice and discrimination because of being disfigured to the point where it's literally driven him underground. And we see that understanding and that address to root causes embodied in that beautiful line, quote, "Pitiful creature of darkness, what kind of life have you known? God, give me courage to show you are not alone," unquote. Now, of course, in a true transformative justice intervention, it wouldn't be left up to Christine as the victim to handle that alone. It wouldn't be left up to her, the victim, to be the one to have to address those root causes. Instead, the community would come in and try to put structures in place to address the Phantom's needs while also providing Christine with safety. So that, for example, if in order to feel safe, Christine felt that she never wanted the Phantom to come anywhere near her again, the community would put in place structures to make sure of that and to hold the Phantom accountable to that, but also to make sure that his needs for acceptance and inclusion and compassion were met without Christine having to be the one to do that. And that's why I say that Phantom gestures to, or is in the spirit of, or invokes or evokes the spirit of transformative justice. Because, yeah, that community element that is present in true transformative justice interventions is missing. Even so, though, like the transformative justice movement, Phantom makes the case in The Final Lair in Act 2, Scene 9, that it is that recognition of and address to the social conditions that are really the root causes of the Phantom's behavior that actually is what finally breaks the cycle of violence that's been building since the first unmasking. Now, that doesn't let the Phantom off the hook for his own wrong behavior, but it does argue that meeting the Phantom's wrong behavior with the further violence of retribution and punishment doesn't actually solve the problem. It just further punishes him for being a quote-unquote monster without actually addressing the conditions that created him as a monster, which then leaves those very same conditions in place to create other monsters in the future. And in point of fact, we do see the Phantom take beginning baby steps toward transformation in his recognizing and accepting that Christine doesn't love him and letting her and Raoul go. Now, true, they are only baby steps, and yes, that is what he should have done, you know, from the beginning, from the first moment she didn't return his affections. But still, it is a beginning of transformation. And he takes those beginning steps in response to having the root cause that pushed him toward rage and violence actually addressed. And that's the genius of the pitiful creature of darkness line that Christine says when she chooses him. Because she's not pretending to love him or promising to pretend to love him. Because she and or Charles Hart's inspiration recognized that in fact her not loving him is not the cause of his rage and violence. It may be the proximal trigger, but it's not the cause. What's at the root of it is, of course, the Phantom's extreme exclusion and marginalization from all of society. And that's what Christine, and through her the story, addresses in that brilliant line. And of course, part of the Phantom's tragedy, then, is that we never get to see him, and in fact he never gets to, take more than those beginning baby steps toward transformation. Because, as mentioned earlier, there's no support structures available, no community to provide support structures for him to make the rest of the journey toward healing and wellness. And of course, in LaRue, it's stated explicitly that he dies shortly after Christine leaves, and so we know definitely that he never gets to make more than those beginning steps towards transformation. And same with Susan Kay. And of course, the Jarek and the stage version are more ambiguous. The Jarek explicitly shows him escaping, but you don't know what the rest of his life after that is like. Love never dies aside. I'll get to that in a whole other episode. And then the original stage version, again, you only explicitly see the Phantom take those very first steps towards transformation or redemption. And what happens after that depends on whether you interpret his disappearing at the end as his escape or as symbolizing his death. And again, like I said earlier about Phantom being so exquisitely trauma-aware, this is another area in which part of Phantom's power comes from its being very true to life. Because all too often, there is severe isolation. There aren't good resources in place to help people make that full journey of transformation from someone who causes harm through a process of healing to being someone who doesn't anymore. So I hope you can see from this why, no, I absolutely do not believe that Phantom condones or glorifies violence or romanticizes violence in general or violence against women. Quite the opposite, in fact. I think, as I've argued earlier, that it frames the Phantom's fall into violence as a tragedy, but a preventable tragedy, and one that should be dealt with and have others like it prevented through something like transformative justice rather than through punishment. And hopefully, too, you can see from this how being a fan, P-H-A-N fan, absolutely does not mean condoning violence, violence against women, or romanticizing violence or gendered violence. Absolutely not. And as I said back at the beginning, I think it's very important for us fans to really be careful to make sure we don't do that. But hopefully I've shown here how it is absolutely possible to have empathy and sympathy and compassion for the Phantom without condoning or romanticizing or sweeping under the rug his more problematic behavior. We can understand where it's coming from and have empathy and compassion without accepting it as okay. And we can work for change in the world to transform the conditions, racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, poverty, etc., that actually enable and breed violence and that create situations like that of the Phantom. And also, of course, we can work to make sure that all communities have the resources they need to be able to actually implement transformative justice, if that's what they want to do. So I hope you all found that discussion interesting. I hope it's given all of you out there a lot to think about and some good food for thought. I'd say I hope you all enjoyed it, but enjoyed feels like a bit of a weird word to use given the topic. So instead, I hope you all found it interesting and thought-provoking. And with that, In This Labyrinth is now officially back on the air. And I must say, I'm really excited and glad to finally be back, and I hope you all are too. And we're back on the air just in time for the 2-year podiversary. I started doing this show 2 years ago this month. Isn't that amazing? I can't believe it's been 2 years already. Wow. And so I'm hoping, as a podiversary treat, to put a second episode up this month to mark the occasion. And I've got what I hope will be some really great episodes planned over the next couple of months. In particular, I'll be reviewing some really awesome Phantom and Phantom-related books, and also hopefully having their authors on the show to do some interviews. That's not absolutely arranged yet, but the authors and I did chat a bit about that before things got derailed. So hopefully it's something that still can be made to happen. I really hope so. That would be really exciting for me and hopefully for all of you too. And when I've got anything concrete on that, I will, of course, shout it out on the podcast, Facebook, and Twitter. So, yeah, watch those spaces for further developments. And on that note, you can get in touch with the show in all the usual ways. Although, as I said back at the beginning, I've been doing a bit of tweaking and renovating, so there's been some minor changes to some of them. So you can follow the show on Twitter at ITL Podcast or tweet to the show at ITL Podcast. That hasn't changed. You can still send an old-fashioned email to the show at inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. And you can still go to the podcast website and leave a comment on the specific page for this or any other episode at http://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm. And of course, you can like or follow the podcast Facebook page and join the Facebook group. But that's where there have been some minor changes, because the name of both the page and the group is still the same as the name of the podcast. But of course, that's now In This Labyrinth, Justice from the Heart of the Phantom of the Opera. But I think if you just search In This Labyrinth on Facebook, you should be good. It should bring up both the page and the group. So just don't be thrown off by the new subtitle. It's still me. It's still the same show. Only more so. So thank you all so much for listening or for listening again. And of course, everyone, please stay safe out there. Wear your masks if you have access to them. Us Phantom fans should enjoy that. Wash your hands if you have access to soap and water to do so, which I really hope you do. And of course, if your circumstances allow it, practice good social distancing. And remember, you're not only doing these things to protect yourself, but to protect others around you, especially the elderly, people with health conditions, and anyone who is more vulnerable. And of course, try to have fun and find joy wherever you can as well. And for us fans, that means enjoy lots of POTO till next time. Disclaimer: the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, the Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.